that, well, this is the expression that we're going to work with for the rate of change of the surface gravity as we go across generators, we have a Ricci term that will end up surviving and that will end up being proved to be zero under some conditions. And then there's that term over here that I claim will be identically zero. And that's what I want to check now. So I want to prove that this is really true. So I won't use this. So in order to put that to zero, we're going to play basically a similar game that that we played before. So I erased some stuff on the boards. But one thing that we've already established is the fact that all the tangential derivatives, all the transverse derivatives of the gradient field are zero. So that's something that told us that that's the condition that comes from the condition that from the statement that our congruence of null generators on the horizon have a zero expansion, zero shear, and zero rotation tensor. So this is just a statement that B alpha beta components of the B tilde tensor in the tangential directions are zero. So what I can do in order to give me information about this is to take that equation and differentiate it on the horizon. And because it's zero everywhere on the horizon, if I differentiate the condition on the horizon, I still get zero. So as a consequence of this, we can take all of this and say that because it's zero everywhere on the horizon, I can differentiate it in the tangential directions and still get zero. And when we expand this, we're going to see that this generates information about the Riemann tensor. It's pretty easy to see how it comes about. So when we differentiate, of course, we generate those two derivatives on the Killing vector, and that will end up telling us what we want to know. So we get that first, and then we get all the other derivatives. So we get A differentiated with respect to gamma. And we get this term, and then we get a third term where we get A alpha A beta B differentiated in the direction of EC. So so we've got that. So this guy, of course, will become, so all of this is equal to zero. This guy will become the Riemann tensor. I'll write it like this. And that basically reproduce what I wanted to have. And the claim is that this is going to be zero because the rest of it is also going to be zero. Here, what I'm going to do is to join this with this. And that gives us something that we worked out before that gives us one of the C terms that we saw happening before. So this is CB, because I'm differentiating in the direction of EB, times C alpha, which multiplies this times that. And over here, what I'm going to do is to do something similar, so except that what I'm going to need to do is to flip the ordering here of the two indices to again bring out the same C term. So I'm going to flip the ordering here, produce the minus sign because of Killing's equation, and I'm going to have C beta differentiated with respect to alpha in the direction of E alpha A, and that will bring me a C term, a C beta, and then the rest of it. So that's what we have, and we're going to see very soon that we get cancellation between those two things. So in what's left over, well, we still get our Riemann term. What's left over here, well, we get the xi alpha multiplying e alpha, and what I can do here is to again transfer the derivatives by using the fact that xi is orthogonal to e everywhere on the horizon. So this gives me another minus sign, and this I'll rewrite as C differentiated with respect to gamma that multiplies E alpha A E gamma C. And again, we'll see that there's another C term that's going to arise from this. Over here, while I'm applying the same trick, I'm going to get plus CA. I'm going to get C differentiated with respect to gamma. And then I'm going to get E beta B E gamma C. So here, so basically I'm just using the fact that C and E beta over here have a zero inner product, so I can just flip the, transfer the derivative from this guy over to that guy at the cost of a minus sign. And at this stage, well, I get more C terms appearing. I have another one over here, CA, C alpha. So that's for this combination over here. Over here, I get C, I get CB, C, So here I had the, so here I did the flip. Here I did the flip again. I have the extra minus sign, but here I need another flip. But then I don't. Oh no, it's the same thing here. So I had to flip over here as well, right? Because I want to combine those two things. So I want to be sure that the index alpha here corresponds to the one that that we differentiate with. So I needed to flip again the order again using Killing's equation. So I had an extra minus sign here, and what you see from all of this is that we get CACB multiplying C. So now it's become gamma. So we get CACB multiplying E multiplied with E, and we get the same thing over here with an extra minus sign. And when the dust clears, we find that zero is equal to a Riemann tensor term. The rest goes away, and as claimed, the Riemann tensor term over here vanishes. And it vanishes as a consequence of this combination of things here being zero everywhere on the horizon by virtue of the stationarity condition. Okay, so I went a little bit quickly here over the details, but if you just follow that and retrace the steps, if you didn't quite see everything that was happening, well, you just find that the extra terms just cancel out, and you only end up with the Riemann tensor term at the end. So any questions about what's happened here? Okay, so now we're at the stage where our derivative for the surface gravity is equal only to the Ricci tensor term. And it's this thing over here. So at this stage, we're almost done. What we need to do then is to convince ourselves that this has to vanish. It doesn't vanish as a matter of identity. We need to put in some additional conditions in order to ensure that this vanishes. And the trick will be to incorporate the dominant energy condition, as I said. So the first thing I'm going to do here is to invoke the Einstein field equations to re-express the Ricci tensor in terms of the energy momentum tensor. So at this point, we're enforcing the field equations. So the Ricci tensor can be related to the energy momentum tensor in the usual way. The trace term doesn't play a role here because those two vectors are orthogonal to each other. Yep.
When we define the C's, we define it like with the N, like little bit here and there too, so.
Sorry?
I'm just wondering how we, so when we define these Cs, we said it's, you know, the covariant derivative of psi contracting with n alpha e beta.
Yeah. No, but the way that I'm using it here is something that we did also before. I worked out before that that this is equal to CA times C. So that's something that came out of our decomposition of the gradient field that we worked out this morning. So I did derive this a little bit earlier, so I used it before for the other part of the calculation, and here I've just been using this again. So in order to use this, of course, that's why I needed to flip ordering of the indices all over the place, because what I really want to do here is to combine those two things together. And in order to do that and use this result over here, I had to flip the ordering here at the price of this minus sign, and then I had what I wanted.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So other questions about these things? Yeah?
Can you just briefly explain how to derive that expression?
How to derive this?
Yeah.
I did that this morning. Yeah, so it's in your notes. It comes, so you just go back to the expansion that we worked out this morning for the gradient for this guy over here, and then you take a contraction, and that's what's left over. So we did do that this morning. All right? So you can take my word for it and check it later. Okay, so we're down here. So as I said, so the trace term doesn't play a role because those two vectors are orthogonal. So the second term drops out. So what we end up with here is something now involving components of the energy momentum tensor. And this is one I want to show, using the dominant energy condition will end up being zero. So the way I like to write this is I like to write it in this form, where I'm going to call this combination here with a minus sign a vector, and I'm contracting this vector here with, I don't know whether there's an A here. I'm looking at the transverse components of that vector, and the vector J is basically the current associated with the energy momentum tensor and the Killing vector on the horizon. So that's the definition of J, and the partial derivative of kappa across generators is proportional to the transverse component of that vector. And the claim is that this will turn out to be zero. Well, the way to prove this is, I think, will be familiar to you. We're going to just do the same thing that we did before. I have a vector. I have a vectorial basis on the horizon. I'm going to decompose that vector into the vectorial basis, and we're going to import some properties and kill off some components and see what's left over. So the vector J can be, can always be decomposed in the vectorial basis that we introduced. In this way. We can get rid of some components by recalling some results that we derived before. One thing that we had derived before is the fact that the components of the energy momentum tensor that correspond to a flux across the horizon had to be zero if the horizon were stationary. So we can import this, and what we're saying here is that the C component of J has to be zero. So we don't pick up a contribution here, but we pick up a contribution here. So this is zero, and that means that B has to be zero, so we kill this term. So J has to be aligned, it has to be tangent to the horizon. It has no component across the horizon. So that's by virtue of the stationarity condition. Now I'm going to incorporate the dominant energy condition, so I'll just remind you what it is. The dominant energy condition is the statement that the vector J, as defined in this way, has to be future-directed, and it can be either time-like or null. But it has to be time-like or null, and it has to be future-directed. So the motivation for this, the reason for this, is that when you look at these, you know, this component of the energy momentum tensor, it really corresponds to the momentum density that would be associated with your matter field, the matter field giving rise to the energy momentum tensor. If you look at those components would describe the momentum density, at least as viewed in a limiting case where the observer would be moving with the speed of light. So it's the limiting case of the momentum density as you take the limit where the observer moves with the speed of light, corresponds to the null ray, the null generators on the horizon. So the statement of the dominant energy condition is that for any vector C that is time-like or null, this contraction of the energy momentum tensor has to be also time-like or null, or future directed. So basically, all this says is that this is an energy momentum tensor where the flow of matter will proceed, toward the future. And that's a pretty important, basic requirement for energy momentum tensors. Is there some
I was just trying to remember why the T contracted with the two C's has to be zero.
Okay, well, again, we did that this morning.
Yes, yeah, sir.
I guess no one was awake this morning, so it's, but it's something that we did talk about this morning as a consequence of Ray Chowdhury's equation for a stationary horizon. So I'm going to impose this. So we're going to impose the dominant energy condition. And this will quickly tell us that vector J, in fact, these components of the vector J have to be zero. So the dominant energy condition tells us that the vector J is time-like, which means that its norm cannot be positive. So it can be a null vector, but it cannot be a space-like vector. So the norm has to be non-positive. Well, we know what J stands for, so we plug in the decomposition. And we work it out. So this is equal to, so this multiplied by this gives nothing because xi is a null vector. This multiplying by this gives also nothing because xi is orthogonal to the transverse vectors. So there are no cross terms. The only thing we pick up here are those two things multiplied together. So we get sigma ab from the inner product of the two transverse vectors multiplying ja multiplying jb. And the statement is that this has to be non-positive, but this is a positive definite norm, so the result has to be greater than or equal to zero. So this by itself, so the requirement is that this be negative, but this by itself is guaranteed to be non-negative because we're dealing with a positive norm, we're dealing with a purely spatial vector. The only way to meet the requirement is for this to be equal to zero. That's the only way we can satisfy both requirements. And that, therefore, guarantees that JA is equal to zero. So the dominant energy condition tells us that the transverse components of the vector are zero. So we can get rid of this. So basically, the condition of stationarity kills off this component over here. The dominant energy condition kills off the spatial components of our current vector, and what's left over is the null component. So the only form of an energy momentum tensor that you can tolerate on a stationary horizon if you impose the dominant energy condition is one where the current is actually null directed, so it just follows. The matter is flowing along with the null generators. But that tells us, again, that, well, that the right-hand side is zero, because when I was writing this out, I was picking out the transverse components. Now we've killed them, and that means, in the end, that, you know, under all those conditions, given the allowed form for the current vector, this vanishes. So J alpha beta, J alpha dotted with EA has to be zero, and then that guarantees that the partial derivative of the surface gravity across generators vanishes. So now we have that. We had that the surface gravity satisfies the killing symmetry. So we had those two statements, and that proves altogether that kappa has to be a constant on the event horizon. And that's the zeroth law. So it's pretty intricate. I mean, there's a lot of steps involved. You have to go through a fairly long calculation. And maybe the most disappointing part of all of this is the fact that we have to involve the Einstein field equations, and we have to involve a dominant energy condition to pull it all off. So that's the proof as was originally presented by Bardeen, Hawking, and Carter back in the early 70s. That's the best they could do at that time. There's been refinements on this since then. There was a paper, I think, from the mid-80s, or maybe later than that, by Bob Wald and somebody else, who actually came up with a different proof, an alternative proof, where, in fact, the property follows without imposing the field equations, without imposing the dominant energy condition. They found a very clever way of proving, in fact, that this follows as a matter of identity. But the proof is, you know, very tricky, very involved. And I think this is, you know, as involved as it was, it's a bit more direct and it's a bit more informative, I think, in the end. But the point is that there are ways of relaxing some of those assumptions and still get a theorem out. This version of the proof, though, requires the dominant energy condition and the field equations. But, you know, if you're willing to live with this, and this is a fairly mild condition on the energy momentum tensor, I mean, you certainly would not expect classical matter to deviate from that. So whenever you use the null, whenever you have a theorem that relies on the weak energy condition or the null energy condition or the dominant energy condition, I don't think you are severely restricting the freedom that you have in the theory. It's not; those are not very strong assumptions. The strong energy condition is a bit of a stupid one, so that's a much stronger assumption that you would like to impose. But some of the singularity theorems, for example, rely on that. But these are, I would say, mild assumptions. Perhaps the thing that makes makes somebody the most uncomfortable is the fact that, well, we do have to impose the field equations. And because we were really trying to be very general here about stationary black holes, the influence of the field equations was very limited throughout. I mean, we sort of saw it through the Ray-Chowdhury's equation, so that's something we saw it there. We see it here in the proof of the zeroth law, but it would be nice to come up with versions of all of this where you don't have to rely on the field equations at all, because your black holes could be, you know, black holes existing in, you know, alternative theories of gravity. And I think it's reassuring to know that there are other ways of proving these things where you don't rely on those, on the field equations. But, you know, again, this version of the proof, the most straightforward one, I think, is one that does rely on the field equations and does rely on the dominant energy condition. Other than that, it doesn't rely on any particular details regarding the Kerr solution. If you do compute the surface gravity for the Kerr solution, you will find that even though the Kerr horizon is deformed, even though there's certainly a deformation, as we talked about this morning, of the horizon itself, the surface gravity is constant on it. so it doesn't seem to be aware of this deformation. It's a nice constant all across the horizon. All right, any questions about any of that? Okay, so that's the zero flaw. A very neat property of black hole horizons. There's a first law that I'd like to talk about next. So the first law is formulated very much like the first law of thermodynamics. So the same language is used. So in thermodynamics, we consider quasi-static, sometimes reversible processes, and we look at what changes to the energy of the system and other characteristics of the system like volume and other things like that, temperature and things like that. So the first law of black hole mechanics looks almost the same. So the wording is something like this. So under a quasi-static process, and it's understood here that we are talking about an infinitesimal change. That takes a black hole from one stationary state to another stationary state. The statement is that the black hole parameters under this change will change in a way that that are related to one another. So the black hole parameters change according to the following equation. The change in the mass can be related to the change in area, and a change in angular momentum. So that's a statement that can be verified for the Kerr black hole. So if you take a Kerr black hole and you change it to a new Kerr black hole with new parameters, new angular momentum, new mass, you can calculate that the area will change according to this equation. So you can do this based on, again, the properties of the Kerr solution, but there's another way of proving this that's a bit more general than that, and that's what I'm going to go through now. Now, this equation looks a lot like the types of equations you would get in thermodynamics. So in thermodynamics, you would consider, for example, changes. You have a gas and you expand it or you compress it. So there would be work terms, there would be heat terms in your first law. So on the left-hand side, you would write the change in the total energy of the system. This, and then on the right-hand side, there would be typically a heat term and a work term. The work term would correspond to PdV if you expand or shrink the volume of your gas. The heat term would correspond to the increase in entropy. That would correspond to a change in a transfer of heat. This term over here is the appropriate work term. So here we don't expand or shrink the black hole. Well, we do, but it's reflected here and here. But by changing its angular momentum, it would be like taking a gas and making it rotate. We can also do work on a gas by changing its rotation rate. And that term over here would be the typical work term you would get in the first law of thermodynamics if you were to look at rotating systems as opposed to expanding or shrinking systems. So this is clearly a work term in the statement of the first law. And this, the notion is that this is interpreted as a heat term because of the fact that, kappa in this packaging of the laws of mechanics would be interpreted as a temperature. So the zero flaw of black hole mechanics being analogous to the zero flaw of thermodynamics brings this analogy between kappa as, you know, as a surface gravity and kappa as a temperature-like quantity in thermodynamics. So the zero flow in thermodynamics, of course, would be the statement that if you have a system in equilibrium that is a stationary system in thermodynamics, the temperature is uniform. Here we have a stationary black hole for which the surface gravity is uniform. So if we imagine that this is analogous to temperature, then this term over here would play the role of a TDS-type term in the laws of mechanics of thermodynamics. And then we're led to considering that, well, the area would play a role analogous to entropy. Yep?
You mentioned in the morning that the omega H is also constant on the horizon.
Yep.
So, yep. I mean, that kind of makes sense in this analogy because that would be like the pressure term, which is...
Which is constant. By mechanical equilibrium, you have to have a constant pressure. Yeah, so that's the same thing here. So the angular velocity being constant basically is a statement that the black hole is in mechanical equilibrium. It rotates rigidly with itself. If it were not, then it wouldn't be a stationary thing, right? So the horizon would still be in the process of settling down to that final stationary state. Yeah, so it's a good point. Okay. So how do we go and prove this? The rest of the story, of course, you know, right? So back in 72, when all of this was done, the analogy was thought to be purely formal, intriguing, but purely formal. And in fact, people would have sworn that, well, black holes cannot be thought of as thermodynamic systems because black holes only absorb things. They never emit things. Therefore, a black hole, you know, the only notion of a temperature you can introduce for a black hole would be zero because that's the only time that, you know, that... So, you know, the only type of body that never emits anything is a body at zero temperature. So a black hole should have been considered to be a zero temperature body. And therefore, there's no entropy to be associated with a zero temperature body. Therefore, all of this is perfectly cute, but, you know, perfectly, you know. So there's no strong analogy. It's just a cute, formal analogy. There's nothing physical about this. But you know the rest of the story. So a couple of years later, Hawking discovers the Hawking process, finds out that, well, in fact, quantum processes around black holes give rise to a flux of thermal radiation, that the temperature of a black hole actually does correspond to the surface gravity up to a factor of 2 pi. And as a result of this, the black hole entropy is, in fact, a quarter of its area. So all of this is familiar. So there's certainly more to this than just a formal analogy. But right now, we don't need to think too much about the analogy. We can just focus on deriving this as a consequence of general relativity, or at least as a consequence of dealing with null surfaces and event horizons in GR. Okay. So. Well, let's go and prove this. So what I need in order to produce this change in my black hole state is a flow of matter. So the black hole will change its mass, it will change its angular momentum, it will change its area because some matter is flowing across. During the flow, of course, the black hole is no longer stationary. So the intermediate state is not going to be a stationary black hole, but I can imagine that the black hole starts stationary, eventually returns to a stationary state, but in the meantime, there was a change. And that change will be produced by an energy momentum tensor that it will take to be infinitesimal. So it's going to be basically almost a test energy momentum tensor, except that I keep track of how much it changes the black hole parameters as a result of the flow across the horizon. So we're introducing an infinitesimal T mu nu. And we know that if there's a T mu nu, if there's a flow of matter across the horizon, there will be a change in mass and there will be a change in angular momentum. We even talked about how to describe this mathematically. So that's something that goes back a couple of weeks ago when we were still dealing with the Hamiltonian formulation. So the change in mass that will be produced by a transfer of matter across the horizon is going to be given by an integral across the horizon, and then it will involve the current associated with the time-like killing vector, not the full killing vector on the horizon. So that's something that we worked out before. So this, uh, we, you know, we noted was a conserved current when you have a time-like Killing vector, and the integral of that current over a hypersurface corresponds to the transfer of mass across that surface. So if I have a flow of energy momentum across the horizon, the way to keep track of the mass change is to evaluate this integral. So that's one member on the left-hand side of the equation there. We have a similar expression for the rate of change of the angular momentum of the vector. Again, that corresponds to a transfer of matter. And this, in this case, it's going to be, you know, this conserved current that's going to be involved inside the integral. This corresponds to the rotational Killing vector. So already we have two terms in our first law, and what I'm going to do is to combine these things together, work it all out, and see what we get from that. So I have two questions. Eric?
Sorry, should the second term be a minus?
The second term is a plus.
Okay.
Yep. Yep, it is. Yep. You had a question?
Do you still have these two Killing vectors when you have matter, flow of matter?
Yeah, so that's the key about the notion of an infinitesimal energy momentum tensor. So here I'm really playing a game of perturbation theory, where I say that I will produce changes in my space-time, I will produce changes in my black holes, in my black hole, but I will calculate changes in all the quantities only to first order in perturbation theory. So this being small, of course, strictly speaking, there is no time-like Killing vector anymore during the transition, and there's no rotational Killing vector during the transition. But working to first order, here I'm allowed to use background zeroth order quantities. So in the background space-time, I still have access to those zeroth order Killing quantities. So this being first order, wanting to calculate this only to first order, everything else can be evaluated as if I'm working on the background of a curve black hole, or background of a black hole space-time with its original Killing vectors, and also using the original expressions for the measure, for the integration measure. So that's a good point. I forgot to mention it, but I'm glad you raised it. Okay, so it's an infinitesimal, and I should say that while this is really reflecting first order changes. And at first order, as I said, I can use the directed surface element on the event horizon, which will be directed along the direction of the, you know, vector C. So it's going to be something corresponding to the area of the cross sections, and then an integration along each along the generators. So the S stands for, you know, the cross sectional area on the event horizon. Okay, so this is the starting point. What I'm going to do is to throw this away, throw this over to the left-hand side, and I'm going to compute it, and we're going to see what we get. So dm minus omega h delta j is going to be equal to an integral over the full event horizon. We're going to have the energy momentum tensor, and here we're going to have T beta plus omega H phi beta that multiplies D sigma alpha. So that's what happens when I take this difference over here. I produce two minus signs, and I end up with this combination here of Killing vectors, which basically gives us our, you know, horizon Killing vector C. So when I put this into here, what I get is plus an integral over the horizon, T alpha beta. I'll write it with the indices like this. We have two vectors C coming from one from this, the other one from that, and then we have the integration over the cross section, and then we have the integration over the generators. If my black hole was remaining stationary during the change, this would be zero, and we wouldn't be talking about the first law, right? So this being non-zero comes from the fact that this component of the energy momentum tensor is not going to be zero during a transformation. All right. So where do we go from here? Well, we invoke the Reicher-Lewis equation. And that's going to be telling us how the area is relating to all of this. So let's go back to Reicher-Lewis. I forget how to spell it. Reicher-Lewis tells us that the rate of change of the expansion is going to be equal to kappa times the expansion minus half theta squared minus the square of the shear minus 8 pi t alpha beta c alpha c beta. So I'm going to solve for this and plug it back inside the integral. Again, I'm working to first order in perturbation theory. So this is something that I expect is small, that I impose, in fact, is small. To zeroth order in perturbation theory, this is zero, theta is zero, and the shear is zero. To first order in perturbation theory, theta becomes non-zero, and sigma becomes non-zero. This term is linear in theta, so it's first order. This term is also linear in theta, so it's first order. This is quadratic, it's second order. So I'm going to neglect this. And I'm going to neglect this as well. So the square of the shear also would be a second order quantity in perturbation theory. So in the end, again, restricting to first order, I'm going to equate this to this minus that. So to first order, 8 pi t alpha beta c alpha c beta is going to be equal to kappa theta minus d theta d. And that's what I'm going to plug in into the integral. And the rest of it will be very straightforward. So delta m minus omega h delta j is going to be equal to, now I get two terms. Kappa, we know, is constant on the horizon, so it's a constant. I can throw it out of the integral. And now I have an integral over h, the horizon, and then I have theta, that multiplies ds, that multiplies dv. And then I have a minus sign, I forgot an 8 pi. Then I have a minus sign, and I have a 1 over 8 pi. I have an integral of dv, d theta dv times ds dv. All right. Well, the rest of it just relies on remembering what theta stands for. So, a couple of things. So, we're integrating over the horizon, right? So, let's picture the horizon, and let's picture the generators on the horizon. So when I integrate for the whole horizon, I integrate from the time before the change started to the time after the change is completed. So I'm integrating over pretty much a whole segment of the event horizon, which means that if the horizon was stationary at that time, so I'm following the flow of the generators here, So if the horizon was stationary before this time and stationary after that time, then I'm integrating over the piece of the horizon in between the initial time and the final time. The way I'm breaking down the integral here means, okay, I'm going to fix v to begin with, and I'm going to take a cross-section of the horizon by cutting across all the generators like that. And I'm going to integrate over this cross-section, and then I'm going to increment in v and integrate along v. So that's the procedure to integrate over h. So let's see if I can draw this in an alternative form. I don't know how to draw it. Well, I can draw it as a space-time diagram. So if I have a horizon that, say, is growing like this, then as I move along v, I'm moving upward along the tube here. So that's moving along the generators. But for fixed v, I'm actually calculating a cross-section like this. I'm actually identifying a cross-section like this. And as I do the integral here, I fix v, integrate over each cross-section, and then I increment along v like that. So that's really the type of integration we're looking at doing. So that's one thing. Each cross-section, it's useful to introduce a notation where the cross-section is going to be denoted by curly E, and the whole horizon is going to be denoted by H. So H is foliated by a bunch of cross-sections like this. So this is a cross-section. It's a cross-section at constant V. We integrate over the cross-section, then we move out in V. Okay, so that's one thing, just to specify a little bit more what we mean here. The other thing that I need to recall is, well, what did we mean by the expansion to begin with? So we go back to what we were doing in section two, and as we follow the flow of the congruence here, the flow of the generators, well, we remember that the expansion actually describes the rate of change of the cross-sectional area. So theta is really 1 over ds dv ds. Because this is, if you take a little bundle of generators, this is going to be the cross-sectional area. That's the rate of change, and that's the fractional rate of change of the cross-sectional area. Okay, well, let's look at the first term. When we look at the first term, well, we're really looking at an integral going from v initial to v final, and then we're looking at an integral over the cross-sectional, the cross-sections. And what we're integrating over the cross-section is theta ds, which stands for ddv ds. Well, the ddv inside the integral can be pulled out of the integral. And I'm differentiating and I'm integrating. Those two operations just undo each other. And what I end up with here is this integral at v2 and at v1. But that integral obviously is the area of the black hole. Right? The cross-sectional area, the integral of the cross-sectional area element is going to be the area of the black hole at that time. So this is going to be the area of the black hole at v2. Minus the area of the black hole at V1. And that's what I mean, of course, by the change in area in my black hole. So the first term gives us what we needed for the right-hand side of the first law. So we have the kappa, we have the 8 pi, we have the change in area. And all of this follows very straightforwardly if you just remember the meaning of the symbols and you just, you know, do this very, you know, very simple sequence of steps. So this is the integral of the, so I should have been more precise here. This is the integral on each cross section of the, you know, surface element. So that by definition will be the cross-sectional area evaluated at V2 and V1, the upper, you know, the lower and upper bound to the integral, and that corresponds to the change in area. The second term will turn out to be zero, so we're going to see that right away. So let's just do the calculation of the second term. The second term, let's deal with it. So we have the horizon integral of d theta dv times ds dv, which means that, okay, we integrate between V1 and V2. And then we integrate over each cross section in between. And what we're integrating here is d theta dv ds. The ddv I can again pull out of the integral. Yeah, and again, I'm differentiating and integrating, which means that what ends up happening is that I take this guy and I evaluate it at V2 and V1. And because I start and I finish in a stationary state, theta was zero at V1 and at V2 and at zero. And all said, then, we have our first law. Yep.
Is there any problem in regularity with, is there a regularity assumption necessary in transferring the derivative out from the integral over h of v?
Yeah. So we're assuming that everything is nice and regular. It's pretty crucial, in fact, that the event horizon be a very nice regular surface. And that's something we'll talk about in a second. So certainly there is a regularity assumption. The event horizon, if it's going to be an event horizon, has to be a smooth submanifold of the full spacetime manifold. We don't care about singularities inside, but the horizon itself has to be a nice regular surface. Yeah, so certainly, you know, those operations, those things that physicists do and mathematicians hate us for doing, like swapping operations and things like that, you know, require all of this fine print that I'm not, you know, putting in. But yeah, it has to be there. Yep.
I'm a little bit confused about these differential arguments. Are we saying that theta is precisely d by dv?
No, so we're not canceling. So yeah, I'm being a little bit glib here. So the notion, so the meaning of this equation is this. So you take a small bundle of generators and you calculate the area. I should really call it, you know, delta S, not DS. So you calculate the cross-sectional area of that bundle at one time, and you calculate it again at some other time. And the congruence will either expand or contract as it does. In this case, it will expand. So you calculate the change, and you divide by the increment in the parameter in the congruence parameter, and then you divide by the cross-sectional bundle. So by the area of the cross-sectional bundle. So I really should be writing it in this form. And then what I'm saying on top of that is that now, okay, I was considering a small bundle. Now I'm going to take a limit where the bundle goes to zero. Those sort of small things will become infinitesimals. And I'm not canceling these things because I'm talking about the rate of change as carried along by the congruence. I'm really talking about the rate of change of this infinitesimal thing as I move along the congruence. So I really don't want to cancel those things. I'm really talking about a physical change in a cross-sectional area that is bounded or, you know, convected along with the motion of the congruence. So yeah, it's a little bit conceptually it's a little bit tricky because of this. You know, again, I'm being very physics-y about doing this, but the point is that when you think of basically doing this idealization of the small bundle into an infinitesimal bundle, then all of this follows. But the key point is really to think of the way of evaluating the integral as something that really follows. So the whole setup here really follows the motion of the congruence. And we're integrating along the congruence and then across the congruence. So we're really going along the cross sections and using, you know, the expansion as a measure of how the cross section changes as we move along the congruence. So it's a fairly subtle thing, but if you're
the separation of congruent lines, right?
Yeah, so the area increases because, well, the average distance between two members of the congruence will increase. Yeah. So, and as that happens, the area of the cross section increases along with it. So sort of thing that when you're used to doing fluid dynamics, it becomes second nature, because in fluid dynamics we're always thinking of Lagrangian derivatives that really follow the motion of fluid elements, and that's the sort of thing that happens here. So we are following, the light rays. So we're really thinking of the light rays as fluid lines, and we're sort of following the motion and setting up the coordinate system and setting up the integration procedure based on that. Other questions about this?
If I can reword it maybe and see if I'm catching it right, the area can be thought of as a function of the parameter d, and then what we're integrating along is a variable, it's a function of the area, and so sort of that's why you do it this way.
Say that again.
That's okay.
So yeah, so the cross sectional area will depend on v.
Mm-hmm.
So as we increment v at each v that we consider when we break down the integral into discrete steps and so on, the way that Riemann tells us we should do it. So for each v that we consider in that sum, we take a cross section, we integrate over the cross section, and that's why I was doing it this way. So first, I state the V integral, so that's the chopping of the integral along V segments, and then we have a cross-sectional integration for each V. And that measures the rate of change of the cross-sectional area as I do it, V by V by V. It requires some thinking. I mean, it's a pretty cute argument, but it's pretty pregnant with subtleties of meaning more than subtleties of mathematics. It's really making sure that you recognize the connection between all of those pieces and the way that they all come together. So it's
the first step of taking the the derivative outside of the integral.
Mm-hmm.
It feels really scary because your bounds depend on v as well. Your bounds.
Well, this one depends. This one, you mean?
Yeah.
This one. In fact, it doesn't, because it's a closed integral. So the cross section is a closed surface. So the bounds of integration are independent of v.
But isn't the area, this might be just subtle.
Why is it the surface? It's a,
so you're worried that there might be some extra V-dependence in here that I'm not, that I'm glossing over. No. no, I agree that it's not completely obvious. You really have to think about this, and I think the best way to think about this is to really try to think of it as following the flow of the congruence and trying to think more carefully about what the operations really mean in terms of how you cut the congruence across each cross section. So there's really no V buried in here in there, and even though here, you know, I've sort of indicated a dependence in V, it's really a, you know, it's really a subtle thing in terms of, you know, specifying the bounds of integration or things like that. So it's actually quite okay, but I think it's something that requires some thinking. Anything else?
Not for me.
Okay, so that's the first law. There are other ways of formulating and proving the first law. This is the version that's known in the literature as a physical process version of the first law, where we are really looking at what's going on in terms of a physical process. Other versions of the first law would be to look at the space of solutions, and you look at basically perturbing one solution and compare. So you would look at one particular solution and you would perturb the parameters of that solution, and you work out how all the various terms here are relating. So all, you know, you would consider a perturbed solution, and you would look at how the perturbed quantities relate to one another, and you would discover a relationship of this form. So formally, it's a different way of proceeding, which is more formal. So you would look at Hamiltonian definitions. You would look at things like that. So way back when, Bob Wall gave a rather rigorous formulation of all of this based on Hamiltonian methods. So you can approach it like this. You can approach it from all sorts of directions. Another way of doing this, probably the most straightforward way, would be to look at, let's look at two Kerr solutions. So you have one Kerr solution for the initial state, another Kerr solution for the final state. Let's look at all the relationships between the parameters, and I present a version of that in the book. But in any case, what we have here, in all of those formulations, is always the same statement for the first law that relates the change in the total energy of the system through its mass with the area and with the change. So this should have been a delta. And it's a very pretty thing. And then, of course, we were talking before about the analogy between this and the first law of thermodynamics, and it's pretty, it's pretty compelling. It's even more compelling when we build in the second law, and that's what I want to talk about now. So to talk about the second law, the good news here is that there will be no mathematics involved. But we'll have to talk about caustics and entry points into the horizon, and the possibility, or rather I should say the non-possibility, of having exit points from the horizon. So let's think about that a little bit. And at this stage, it's going to be all cartoon stuff. So I started the discussion of black holes with my favorite ways of representing what a black hole does. We have gravitational collapse, and I was looking at those light rays that are emitted from the center, some of them going to infinity. earlier on when the collapse is still early and when gravity is still weak. We have light rays that are emitted late and end up going out of the star but then recollapsing immediately. And then we have this limiting case here of the event horizon where the light ray is emitted at just the right time so that by the time it has cleared the matter, it stays stationary forever. So so here I drew only on one side of this. I can draw the other side of this. And of course, all of this is imagined to be rotated like that. Those light rays didn't have to be emitted from the center. I could imagine the entire past history of that light ray. And this light ray, for example, would have a past where, well, we track it from where it was emitted way back when, early over there, and then it was moving in toward the black hole, passing through the center at just the right time, so that by the time it was emerging through the other side of the collapsing star, it was held stationary by the gravitational field. So before I was describing this in terms of a creation or an emission from the center, but in fact we can look at the previous life of the light ray and imagine that it was really coming from this side and passing through the center, and then by the time it was re-emerging from the other side, it was held captive by the gravitational field. This light ray, in the same way, was coming from this side, and it was converging toward the center, and it passes through the center at exactly the right time so that when it emerges from the matter, it is held stationary at all times. So the point is that the event horizon was created right here. It didn't exist before. It was created at this instant of time. And at this instant of time, we have light rays converging to a point, and they all cross that point. Here I'm imagining spherical symmetry, so this is happening in all directions. And what we have is a classic caustic of our congruence of light rays. They all converge, they all merge into a caustic, and then on the other side of the caustic, you have the creation moment of the event horizon. So the event horizon is created at a past caustic. In spherical symmetry, that caustic would be a single point. If we introduce deviations from spherical symmetry, it's going to be some two-dimensional surface, and the light rays going through that surface, going through that sort of ring, will all be captured by the event horizon. So now we'll have a creation moment that corresponds not to a single point, but some extended surface. It doesn't have to be a ring, it can be a surface. So the point is that horizons have a past, and we can have entry points into the horizon at caustics. So caustics are entry points into the event horizon. So that's observation number one. Let's look at a slightly fancier version of this. Let's look at a black hole that is the result of a merger of two individual black holes. So let's look at a black hole that was initially two black holes. So here's one. So I'm drawing the event horizon of one, and then I'm drawing the event horizon of the other. At some point, they merge, and then we have a black hole surviving as a larger black hole after the merger. So I'm drawing the event horizon, and here I'm sort of forgetting about the creation moments for each one. So at that point down here, there would be, an individual creation moment for this guy, and over here too. But we've talked about this, and it's not terribly important here. So we would have past caustics over here, along the lines of those ones over here. But now we have more caustics being produced by the merger. What happens here at the crotch is very interesting. So what happens as the merger occurs is that, well, here we had all those light rays, those generators of the event horizon, that pretty much keep on a happy existence as the merger occurs. They're just absorbed in a very smooth way by the combined event horizon, or by the, you know, the merged event horizon. So we have a bunch of generators on the event horizon that basically follow the null hypersurface through the merger without being disturbed. So those would be light rays that entered either this horizon or this horizon, and then just stayed on forever, and they will keep on staying on forever, and that's the point I'm trying to make. At the crotch, we have the possibility for new generators to enter the horizon. What can happen at this point is something along the lines of what was happening here, back here or up here. What you can have is a light ray that was not initially on the horizon. For example, it can come from behind. And it can choose to enter right here. Well, it doesn't choose to enter. It's just at that point, it's coming from behind the merging black hole. So the black holes are merging this way. There's a light ray that was, coming from behind. And at merger time, gravity has become so strong that that light ray has become absorbed by the black hole, and it will now participate into the event horizon. So that light ray that comes from behind enters the horizon right here at a new caustic point. And there could be another light ray coming from the other side that will also enter over here through another caustic point. And there could be more. So you have new generators entering the horizon at that point, coming from light rays that were unfortunate enough to be captured by the gravity of the black hole after the merger. So here there's a distinction to be made between, basically the original generators that were there at all times, and the new ones that are basically coming to life, or coming into the existence of the event horizon at a new caustic that's created by the merger. So here we have another caustic that's produced by the merger that corresponds to new entry points for new generators. And again, here I've simplified the picture, so it looks like the caustic is a point, but in fact, it's typically a line. So if you don't have any symmetry, then the entry into the new horizon will correspond to a full line here. So the crotch is, a full line that sort of straps around here, and light rays passing through that line will be absorbed into the merged event horizon. So the point of all this is that the notion of an event horizon pretty much comes with the fact that there are some past caustics through which new generators enter. This happens sometimes at the moment of creation of the black hole, but sometimes it happens later at the moment of two black holes merging. At moments like this, there's room for more generators to come in, and when they come in, they come in through caustics. Now, something very important about caustics is the fact that, well, we know that caustics represent singularities of our congruence. And it's not too surprising. This congruence is perfectly fine and regular, but at this point, new generators are entering, and they all emerge from that, one line or that one point. And that corresponds to a point where the expansion was minus infinity. So at a point of caustic entry, the expansion, because it all proceeds from something that has zero cross-sectional area, it could be a point or it could be a line, it has zero area. Because of that, at the caustic, theta started out with minus infinity, and then, of course, minus or plus? It's expanding. It's expanding from a point, therefore it's expanding infinitely fast away from that point. and then those congruences, those new generators join in. And they will join then smoothly with the other generators, and at that point, after this, we have a perfectly fine congruence again, perfectly non-singular congruence. So we know that caustic points like this, or caustic lines, represent a singularity of the congruence. They also correspond to a singularity of the event horizon itself. So we were just talking about the need for the event horizon to be a nice regular surface. This doesn't apply here. Here we have a conical type singularity in the event horizon. And here we have another type of conical singularity. I'm not sure if it's technically called the conical singularity. But here we have a submanifold of the, a null submanifold of the space-time that's not regular. There's a form of singular behavior here. So entry points into an event horizon at caustics is also a singularity of the null hypersurface, or the null submanifold. So we can have caustics, and we can have non-smoothness when new generators join the horizon. You have a question?
Is this true in all coordinate systems? So for example,
I'm not saying anything about coordinates. So there's really, so it's really a geometrical statement here about the behavior of the congruence as a congruence. Right. The question is, for the second law, what's really critical, the question is, can we have future caustics? Can we have exit points to the horizon? Can we turn this around and have a black hole splitting up into two black holes? Can we have future caustics? Can we have exit points? So entry points correspond to caustics. Exit points would also have to correspond to caustics. So if we had a horizon, so let me draw again a slice, a sort of a slice of the horizon. So let me draw some generators, and let me assume that there would be the formation of a caustic here in the future evolution of my null generators. If we had that, it would be the end of the event horizon. And that's key. A caustic is a singularity in the congruence. It's also a singularity in the null hypersurface. We cannot guarantee that the null surface will remain smooth if we have caustics popping up all over the place. If we have a caustic like this, we could not guarantee that the continuation of all the geodesics would be confined to the same hypersurface. We could not, in fact, guarantee a continuation of that surface beyond the caustic. What would happen typically is that through a caustic like this, we would have one, at least one of those light rays making an escape to infinity. And if we allowed that, that would be the end of the event horizon, because what do we have? We have a light ray that was supposed to be captured by the black hole. We have a surface that was supposed to be a causal boundary beyond which we would not be able to see anything about the inside of the black hole. But that light ray, let's say this one over here, has made an escape and is telling us something about the interior. Well, not directly. So this light ray is telling us about the event horizon itself, but there could be another light ray just beneath the event horizon, just below the event horizon, that would crop up in here and make also an escape. So if we want the black hole horizon to be a causal boundary forever, and that's a basic requirement, because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have a black hole, we wouldn't have an event horizon. The very notion, the very definition of an event horizon is that we have this causal boundary that will keep on living forever. Otherwise, we would not have a causal boundary, and we would not have a meaningful notion of a black hole. If we want all of this, if we want black holes to begin with, if we want to have event horizons to begin with, we have to declare that future caustics will not occur and that exit points are forbidden. if we allow for caustics, we allow for future exit points, and then we cannot guarantee the integrity of the event horizon as a causal boundary. So exit points, we have to say no, because these would violate the integrity of the event horizon as a causal boundary. It's okay in the past, because you're basically forming that boundary. You're shaping that boundary. You're defining that boundary. And you can always add new generators. What you don't want is to remove generators by letting them escape all the way to infinity. And if you have future caustics, you will not be able to guarantee that this doesn't happen. And once you know that, you have the second law. Because if we have a congruence of generators and we want to guarantee that no caustics will ever be encountered unless new generators join, we have to make sure that the congruence is never contracting. Okay? So no future caustics except at new entry points guarantees by the focus theorem that the congruence of generators cannot be contracting anywhere on the event horizon. The focusing theorem says that if it starts contracting anywhere, if you have any patch here on the event horizon where the generators are contracting, then the focusing theorem guarantees that they will keep on contracting until they meet a caustic. That cannot happen. Therefore, it cannot be contracting anywhere. If it's not contracting anywhere, it's either stationary or it's expanding. So the congruence has to be expanding. And if it's expanding or non-contracting, if it's non-contracting, let's say it like this, the horizon area cannot be decreasing, because if the congruence is expanding, the area will expanding along with it. So in the stationary case, the area stays the same. In the expanding case, the area would increase. In the contracting case, obviously, the area would decrease. We rule this out. And we have the statement that the area can only increase. And in fact, it's increasing for two reasons. It's increasing because the congruence has to be increasing, or at least non-contracting. But it's also increasing because at points like these, you allow new generators to come in, and they need space. So they'll basically force the horizon to move out a bit to create more room for the new members of the congruence. For those two reasons, you have that the area can never decrease. And the area can never decrease because the congruence can never contract. If it were to contract, it would create a caustic. And that would mean the end of the event horizon as we know it. And that's the proof of the second law. So there's more fine print to it. If you look at Hawking's original article, there's a lot more going on to put in all the fine print and prove all the all dilemmas and all the propositions that need to go into this. But the essential ideas are just these. And the essential ideas can be summarized in cartoons. And it relies on the focusing theorem. So the focusing theorem that we talked about many weeks ago is something that directly goes into that. So, yep.
If your space-time was static, so that you have time reversal invariance,
yep.
Then you say that you can have past caustics but no future ones, but if you reverse your time, don't past caustics become future caustics?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So so all of this here gives us an arrow of time, right? So general relativity itself and all the laws of physics pretty much that we know are time reversal invariant. When we deal with black holes, we give it up. Black holes are not time reversal invariant things because they're designed to have future causal boundaries. So a black hole is defined to be the region from which you cannot emit light rays that go to infinity. Those light rays are going in a future direction. if you were to define the time reversal of this, you would be defining a white hole. So if you apply this to white holes, you turn it around, right? So black holes can never split up, because that would represent a future caustic. White holes will split up. That's a question that often occurs, and people are sometimes confused about this. So any statements that you make about black holes, any properties of black holes, don't have to be time reversal invariant, because the very definition of a black hole breaks time reversal invariance. We are making statements about the future causal boundary of the space-time. So that's the resolution of that sort of apparent paradox. Yep.
In the last few years, there's been a lot of progress in simulating black holes and black hole dynamics.
Yep.
Have people, I just thought of this question now, thought of white hole dynamics and simulating those?
Not to my knowledge, because the beauty of black holes is that you can start with regular objects, let them collapse into black holes, and then you can study that numerically, and that can be done very well. The problem with white holes is that they really start with singularity. And that doesn't mean that it would be impossible to model them, or to simulate them, but I think it's just a little bit harder than for black holes. And I think also, well, the physical motivation for this is pretty limited, so no one has given it much thought. But yeah, that doesn't mean that it wouldn't be interesting to simulate, you know, how white holes, you know, split up and various things like that.
I mean, wouldn't it just be you run a black hole simulation and then turn time around?
Almost, except for the fact that when you talk about black holes, you're really talking about a lot of it would just be turning it around. But in order to actually think of the analog of the event horizon for white holes, I think you would have to think a little bit harder about what this all means. So I'm not aware of any serious work on that, but it might actually be interesting to see what the differences would be. I just want to ask your indulgence. I would just want to say something for maybe 5 more minutes, just to really wrap this up completely. Again, at the level of cartoons, I want to consider a really dynamical situation and look at the behavior of the event horizon, because there's something a little bit funny about it. The event horizon breaks time reversal invariance, but in some sense it also breaks causality. And I want to just describe this and explain why it's not a real breakdown in causality. So suppose we have a black hole, so much like this one. So it was formed at some point, but let's suppose that at some later time it starts absorbing more matter. So we have this, the first creation moment. So here's the singularity. Here's the first creation moment. And here's the time at which we start absorbing more matter. So more matter is going to fall in from this direction and from that direction. So that's just the flow of matter. So thinking back about this situation right here, the way that we were locating the event horizon before was to say, okay, let's look at the light ray that starts from the center this time. And that light ray is going to be basically focused and focused and focused by the infalling matter until it clears out of the infalling matter and it remains stationary ever since. So in that way of representing things, the event horizon is generated by those light rays that are focused by just the round amount, the right amount, by the infalling matter, so that at the end of it, it emerges with no expansion at all. So it starts with positive expansion. The expansion decreases by the focusing theorem, by the infalling matter. And then after the last of the matter, you end up with no expansion left. In this diagram, the old, you know, event horizon would correspond to those expanding light rays that become stationary after all of this matter has fallen through. And they would stay stationary until they encounter more matter. And if you have a stationary light ray that encounters more matter, it's going to be focused by that matter, and it's going to start contracting again. So that congruence of light rays is going to start contracting, and the added gravity here will make this light ray collapse back to the singularity. So you thought that you'd located the event horizon, but you were wrong, because the matter that falls in later, and it could be thousands or it could be billions of years later, will in fact produce this additional contraction. And this light ray, which you thought was the event horizon, in fact was confidently inside the black hole. What you need instead is an earlier light ray that you thought would make it out to infinity. So it was expanding for a long while until it catches the infalling matter. And now it's going to start contracting until it encounters the last of that matter, so that this light ray over here will emerge stationary. That's the event horizon. This was not, even though to you or me it looked a lot like the event horizon, it had all the usual properties of the event horizon, but it was not the event horizon, because the actual event horizon had to account for all of the matter that will fall in the infinite future. And you have to basically look for this limiting light ray such that after all of the matter clears, you end up with zero expansion left. And you have to wait until all the matter clears. And before that happens, those light rays were always expanding, because you have to wait for all the matter to do the right amount of focusing in order to produce the stationary surface. So if there was more matter yet falling at later times, well, we would encounter the same situation. So you would have to consider another light ray that was emitted even earlier. And that would be the true event horizon. So the true event horizon is sitting outside here. This was what's known as an apparent horizon. It looks like a horizon, but it's not. And it's not a horizon because this light ray eventually is captured by the black hole. So here's the cute thing about this. When we think about this carefully, we know that event horizons are really constructed by looking at what's going on at infinity, you know, at future infinity. So we wait forever. And if we wait forever, we know that things have settled down. And in order to locate the event horizon, what we really have to do is to launch a stationary light ray from plus infinity, and we propagate it backwards in time. And then we're going to go that backwards in time, it really initiated here. So event horizons are really begging to be traced as a backwards process, where you specify the final conditions and then you figure out what it had to do before then, before that. So in that sense, a horizon is something that satisfies a bunch of differential equations, where you specify the final conditions instead of specifying the initial conditions. And in that sense, they have this non-causal behavior. You really have to know what's going to happen for an infinite time before you can really be sure that you're dealing with the event horizon. So in that sense, they have this acausal behavior, but of course, it's not really acausal behavior. All the while, we're talking about the light ray that was doing whatever it needs to do, right? It expands, and then it encounters matter, it gets focused, and eventually it ends up being focused to the extent of remaining stationary. So each light ray along the sequence over here, the one down here that was expanding forever, the one that here was expanding for a while but was recollapsing, all of those light rays individually behave in a completely causal manner. They just do their thing. The thing that's not obvious is that which light ray is it going to be that we're going to declare is a generator of the event horizons. In order to answer that question, we really have to look at the final conditions. So that's what's referred to as the teleological property of the event horizon. And teleological refers to final causes. And you can't escape those final causes if you want to really talk about the event horizon. A misleading way of presenting all of this, and sometimes it's irresistible to present it like this, is to say that the event horizon is going to be this light ray that is emitted at just the right time so that by the time all the matter clears, it stays stationary. While I said that, it's not misleading, it's exactly what happens. The misleading way of representing this is to say that the light ray starts expanding in anticipation. So one way of saying this that could be misleading and something you hear sometimes is to say that this light ray was emitted at the right time and it was expanding in anticipation of encountering all of this matter, so that by the time it has encountered the matter, it becomes stationary. So it's an anticipation that turns out to be a little bit misleading because, well, the light ray doesn't anticipate anything. The light ray just does its own thing. It just so happens that this light ray gets crowned generator of the event horizon after everything is said and done. It didn't know that ahead of time, right? No one knew that ahead of time. But after everything clears, after the dust is settled, we know which one was the right one and we crown him, you know, event horizon. But there's no anticipation of anything. But I just wanted to point this out because it's often something you'll hear and sometimes people will get confused or will object and say that, well, it's not really what's going on. But sometimes it's irresistible to say it like this. The event horizon does what it has to do in anticipation of all the matter that will ever fall forever and ever toward the black hole. All right, well, I think I've said all that I know about black holes, I think I'm pretty satisfied with what we managed to cover in this course. I don't think we'll need extra lectures next week, so I think we'll quit here, and as I ask you, so next week I'll expect you to give me your titles and abstracts. I'll distribute the program for the symposium in the week that follows, and then you'll do the presenting, and I'll do the learning, and it's going to be a lot of fun for me. So, any questions before we quit?
So if there's no end to shoving matter into the black hole, there's no event horizon?
Yeah, and that would mean that you have to shove in, you know, an infinite amount of mass, and you know, that opens up other issues.